Welcome to Build Invisible, a podcast hosted by me, Daniel G, where we explore career journeys of today's most successful professionals. Each week, we sit down with guests to discuss the challenges they faced and the lessons that they've learned along the way, from dealing with failure to the importance of being patient and listening to others. We uncover the strategies and mindset that have helped our guests build successful careers. Join us as we delve into the stories of those who have persevered and achieved greatness in their fields. I chatted with Essan Shah, and he outlined why rest and recreation are more important to him than waking up at 5 a.m. and why listening and accountability are two of his core business values. Essan is the founder of Be Engaged, an organization which specializes in sports and gaming marketing activations. With over 21 athletes and 15 brands as clients working with Be Engaged, with the objective of maximizing ROI through the sporting audience. Aside from Be Engaged, he has founded and invested and is on the board of advisors for a number of other businesses. Essan is passionate about growing business within the sports industry and green and sustainable industries through an eco VC fund vehicle created to bring like-minded people and organizations together. I hope you enjoy the chat. Okay, Essan, thanks for joining. We've done this a few times now, so I appreciate on various different things for you having the time to talk as always. And, you know, we talk a lot actually about sort of behind the scenes stuff in the industries that we work in generally, and the habits, the stuff that sets people apart, the ability to be able to, you know, do business in a pretty difficult sector, if you call it sport or entertainment or content or whatever you want to call it generally. You know, you're someone that has come through the ranks, built a pretty big company, and worked probably in one of the toughest sectors in one of the most difficult times, I guess, over the last few years, especially. One of my big things is what I'm trying to write about to a degree is, you know, building the invisible. That's almost the name of the book to a degree. How do you go about building your network, your knowledge, your expertise? How do you manage to sell to clients so that they, you know, feel that they're getting value and they're getting expertise and everything that goes from there? I know it's a while back now, and maybe one of the questions that I was thinking about asking was, you know, how do you think about getting into the sector? How did you think about targeting it? How did you think about working in it? I know it was a little bit more by chance for you, but if you're able just to give us a few minutes background as to how you went from, you know, effectively student life and maybe, you know, not thinking that sports or entertainment was for you into probably the sweet spot of the sports and entertainment universe, really.
Yeah, I think, I don't know if you've ever read the book Outliers.
Is it there? Just behind you?
Yeah, Malcolm Gladwell's one. Yeah, really? Just there. So I always, when I read that book, it kind of resonated with me quite a lot, because at the time when I was in university, it was always, for me, it was all about the financial industry. I really wanted to kind of like work my way into management consulting or some sort of role within that banking and finance industry space, about building businesses or helping build them or sell them on. And I slowly started to realize that wasn't for me. So it wasn't a matter of, like, as a teenager or in my early adulthood at university, I knew I wanted to get into sport. For me, it was all about a completely different industry, but that industry for me, I didn't resonate with. Once I started to work within there through internships, it was all about, can I envision myself being that person later on in life? And I didn't want to be in that situation. So I kind of had to reevaluate what I was looking for, what pathway I wanted to kind of build for myself. And because I'm a person that plans and always wants to think 5-10 years ahead, I was thinking that way kind of at that age. And then from there, it opened my eyes to being, I don't want to be someone consistently stuck behind a desk in a huge office building, working completely ridiculous hours. So for me, it was about, okay, shifting that understanding and researching into industries that allow me to kind of express myself in completely different ways. And through that research and through talking to other people in other industries, other sectors, speaking to people at university who are doing other courses around outside of economics and finance, I started to understand that the world of marketing, that there's still a philosophy that kind of resonates, because I was still massively interested in business. So it was about applying all of those understandings to the marketing sector. So I kind of very much opened myself out to the marketing world more so than sports marketing. And within there, one of the modules was marketing communications. And within that module, there was a small segment on sports marketing and communications. And I kind of started to take a bit of a lean towards that, just naturally being a sports or a football fan. And there was a company local to the university that was doing an internship. So I started working with them, and they had two sports brands as clients, one being Nike, another one being Tennis Point, which is a tennis online retailer. So working with them, I started to realize actually, for me, this is far more interesting. So how can I completely dive into this? So I think I would work there 3 days a week. It was a Monday, Wednesday, and a Friday. I would go there every single day after my lectures. And at some point, I started to get to a point where I wouldn't go to lectures, go to do that work. And then I would just catch up with the lectures online when they put it all online. So that was kind of like my cheat code to doing that. And that just opened me up to kind of experience things in the working environment that maybe I wasn't able to experience from university. And then from there, I started to kind of have a passion for the athlete side of things, which was athletes are brands too. So why aren't people talking about it? And then that's kind of by chance, I ended up in that situation, and kind of bringing it back to Outliers. It was, I was of the right generation, which was the generation where at 17, 18, Facebook, Twitter were the big things. So we were pretty much brought up on it, but we weren't brought up on it from 13, 14, 15. We were in that prime spot of social media industry, which was younger. It was MySpace and MSN. As you grew older, it started to commercialize it through Facebook, Twitter. And then I think I was one of the early adopters amongst like my friendship group of Instagram when I think I just went to uni in 2010. So when we're talking about being in the right place and the right time of a generation, I was a generation of that social media and the players that I could connect with and kind of work with through the internships and through some of my friends were of that generation as well. So they had a passion for that. So then you then start to think, okay, why hasn't a company done this in the past? It was largely because they were old school organizations. So old school PR, old school marketing, or they just didn't see athletes as a commodity that you could commercialize because it wasn't really done before. Beckham was really and truly one of the only people before that generation of footballers that had done it in the UK, but in the States they were doing it for 5, 6, 7 years. So it was looking about, okay, what is working in the States that isn't working here? And it was the ample amount of supply and demand in that industry, whereas the supply is huge in terms of players, but no one's creating that demand. So it's ultimately who can create that demand, and there wasn't really anyone that was really doing it in the UK. And you end up in a position where you work with a couple of smaller companies that are trying to do it. Some work, some don't. And then you end up in a position where 2 years on, you're like, right, okay, cool. I may as well just do this myself because no one's really cracked it. It's either because they haven't done it the right way or that there isn't an opportunity or a space in this market here for that in this culture. And it just transpired that I was in the right place at the right time, but then took that opportunity to kind of build what we've got now.
So can I ask a specific point there? Because I like that everyone that I've spoken to that had some decent levels of success in the entertainment sector or the passion sector, as I call it, if it's film or TV or fashion or music or jewelry or whatever else it might be, is they use the word luck a lot, which I almost sometimes think is a bit of a self-deprecating tool, almost like, yeah, I was here and lucky and in the right space and at the right time. And I definitely agree to a degree that that plays its part. What it sounded like from other things that I've read and people I've spoken to is what actually happens is sometimes competing ideas of things that you're either really curious, interested, passionate about, almost merge together to form the thing that then sets you apart. So if social media and being an early adopter mixed with your interest and passion for marketing mixed with sport and mixed with all of those in that sort of fulcrum actually then provided the competitive advantage that enabled you to be able to then push forward and turbocharge quicker than potentially others. It's almost those non-exclusive ideas that form that sort of launch pad for you. I know it's hard for you to say, yes, I saw that opportunity and I did it. But that's what it sounds like. Maybe what I can say, what it looks like from the outside, that then gave you quite a good starting point.
Yeah, and no, I think it's an interesting conversation around luck, because on the flip side, some the people that have taken advantage of the situation that they're in and kind of built something for themselves, they've had to have a certain mentality to those that weren't able to do that. Because when we look at it, there are plenty of people that have the same passions as you and the same opportunity in terms of a generation or education or whatever it might be in terms of like where you're brought up, right? So if we look to the UK, there's plenty of people in the same university as me, plenty of people that were interested in the same things as me. But it's about how you tackle that mentality, which is, for example, the opportunity cost at that period of time was, do I do this for no money for I don't know how long, or do I just go down the safe route and know, okay, I will graduate, I'll be on a grad scheme for 40,000 a year for 2 years, and my progression is this. That's the opportunity cost and all of that, which is that mentality towards, do you want to risk it or do you not want to really risk it? And plenty of my friends went down that route. I was that only one out of a friendship group of about 10 of us from school that decided to go down a completely different route. And for the first 2.5 years where you're doing something for nothing, people are questioning why you're doing this. But the reality is you've got more chances of that not succeeding than succeeding. But it's ultimately how much of an opportunity do you want to create for yourself as well. So there's that element of, yes, you are lucky in that sense that you were born in a certain generation or you were born in a certain country, in a certain environment, culture, X, Y, and Z. There's so many other different things, because there are plenty of other people around this world that don't have that opportunity just out of geographical situations or economical situations for the countries that they live in. So yes, that is a luck part, which you just happen to be in that part, but how do you use that luck, or how do you create that opportunity and turn that luck into something? I think that's that comes down to the mentality of a person, whether how balancing out the opportunity cost, what is worth it for you and what isn't worth it for you. I think that's ultimately, yes, you are lucky in some certain senses, but so is everyone that lives in this country. So is everyone that has an education. So is everyone that has a roof over their head. That is so many things that other people don't have in this world. But how do you use that and kind of like build on that?
And in terms of their mentality, I think one of the fascinating areas that I'm always really interested to hear and hear people speak about is this whole habit making, habit breaking, habit forming stuff that, you know, people do. If it's the small increments, a lot of people call this like the compounding effects, like very, very small changes over a long period of time, which compound into quite bigger things as a result. You know, the parody of all of this is, you know, everyone waking up at 5 o'clock and, you know, doing their 3 hours of gym exercises and meditation and contemplate and all of that type of stuff, which is at the extreme end, which, you know, certainly isn't for everybody. But I'm sort of more thinking about the types of behaviors that are maybe perhaps more realistic, that, you know, normal, highly driven, successful, performance orientated people do on a sort of daily basis. You know, are there particular things that have held you in good stead, either from people opening up some of their habits and secrets and ideas to you, or you finding your way on particular things and working out what works best?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting topic, because I don't think one person's process can completely be replicated and work for another person, because each individual human is completely different in the way that their minds work, their bodies work, and their attention spans work as well. So for me, it was all about a trial and error in terms of, from a young age, knowing what worked for me then changed to what works for me now. And I think I'm not a big fan of these opinions that you have to wake up at 5 a.m., you have to do this, you have to do certain things in a certain way, because realistically, if you're working off a 5 hours sleep, it's impossible for you to function anyway. So one, sleep is the most important part in all of that entire component, that if you're not sleeping well, the rest isn't going to work. But for me, it's about what's always worked for me that I can try and implement with the team that we have as well, which is between 9 and 11 every day, we only do internal work. In terms of, you will not externally talk to a client or a prospective client or a media entity or whatever it might be. 9 to 11 is all about you and your internal work. So that kind of frees up your day then, that after 11, you can then do your external things, because what naturally happens is once you start booking in meetings, you can end up talking a lot and not doing a lot. So when people talk about starting at 5 a.m. and ending at 9 a.m., you're just inefficient. Actually, you can do this 9 till 6 if you structure out your day and structure out your week. So on a Monday morning, 9 to 11 is literally project management work. So you will not do any physical delivery of work. You will literally just work with your team, make sure that everything for the week is aligned, and then you kind of have that in place. So something that worked for me in terms of 9 to 11, always internal work, we've brought that to the team and helped them organize themselves, because you're actually physically putting aside 2 hours of your 40-hour week to organize. If you spend those 2 hours, your other 38 hours are going to work far more efficiently. You don't have to wake up at 5 a.m. You don't have to work till 9 p.m. It's that element of bringing efficiencies through organization. That for me has always massively helped. And that coming back to that Monday thing, I always have a list of the things I have to finish by Friday, because I know this week, these are my list of things that I need to do. From that list, I will then divide it into, okay, this is due by Tuesday. I need to make sure I do this by end of Monday to deliver on Tuesday. And then you start to have like a systematic approach every Monday or Sunday night, whatever is easier for people to work out their week, divide that. And then you've got your week specifically planned out. If you start to overrun, then you probably need to come back and kind of question, okay, where did that overrun? Why was it inefficient? I think they are the most kind of like important points for me. And then people talk about exercise. For me, 30 minutes in the morning is enough. It kind of opens my mind, opens my body in terms of, it's also 30 minutes away from thinking about what you have to do. You can literally just focus in that 30 minutes on something completely irrelevant. And a lot of people kind of ignore this as well. I think there's a setting on the iPhone now, which you can, it's called downtime. So you set the downtime that you need between that. So between, I think it's 10 p.m. and 7 a.m., other than WhatsApp and iMessage, all my other apps are blocked, so I can't use them. So that kind of like forces me not to be on my phone, to just watch TV, or recently with the new Call of Duty coming out, I just play Call of Duty for one and a half hours maybe at night. But you're immersing yourself into a different world. And I think people underestimate that element of you detaching yourself away from reality. People say, you shouldn't play video games or you shouldn't watch TV, but it's so healthy for the mind to kind of distract yourself away from something that isn't physically work. Mm. And I think people that work in an agency field or a service field, you can lose that so quickly, which is you always want to be on, and you will naturally hit a burnout. You will naturally become inefficient. So having those 2 hours for your mind to turn off is so, so, so important.
Hello, and welcome back to Build the Invisible with me, Daniel G. In addition to sharing insights and lessons on career success, I'm also the founder of a charity fashion brand called 13. At 13shop.co.uk, you can order hoodies, t-shirts and socks, with all proceeds going towards cancer research. So not only can you evaluate your personal and professional development with the insights shared on this podcast, but you can also support a great cause with your purchase from 13. Visit 13shop.co.uk today to browse our collection and make a difference. Thank you for supporting Build the Invisible and the mission of 13.
I couldn't speak more highly about that point generally. I find, and we've talked about it a little bit before, about, you know, a lot of the year I'm always very reactive to things. Obviously, I'm planning and doing or whatever else it might be. But usually after the transfer window ends in September or August, and then at Christmas time, that's my sort of time, my more of my downtime, which is I'm not reactive to stuff as much. The workload generally starts to calm down. And after two or three days of rest, my brain waves sort of change, if that's the right way, from either going like this to like this or whatever the equivalent might be, so that you get back into a slightly different mode of creative thinking. That's how I try and see it sometimes. And once your brain's calmed down a bit, even if it's short-term rest, like a couple of hours off that you need to regenerate and re-energize, or slightly longer periods for you to recover and be ready to sort of assess what you need to do for a slightly longer period of time, I actually find that a very useful exercise as well. How do you find that difference between short-term, you know, distraction of screen time versus slightly longer-term habit strategy planning when you need that longer amount of or period of time or whatever else you want to call it to think more broadly about the things you need to be doing?
Yeah, I think one of the things that I'm always conscious of is consistently being on a screen, because I think there's an element where you can get distracted. So you open your laptop, there's emails, there's WhatsApp, there's Slack, some people use Slack. There's so many different opportunities for you to become distracted. So when it comes to strategical things or important tasks which require complete focus and attention, I tend to use notepads. So one of the kind of routines or a habit that I've kind of like fallen into is having three notepads, and these three notepads will always be with me. One is for internal strategic business use, which is all about our business, our people. There's another notepad which is external. So when I'm meeting with clients or prospective clients or whatever, whoever that might be, to only have those notes in that book. And then I have another one which is just like a sketch pad or a complete quick for notes, and that allows me to strategically align my notes into different places, so I know, okay, when I'm working in this, if I flick back through the pages, I will only see words or notes or something which are relevant to the work that I'm doing now. If I'm in a client one, I flick back and I will only see notes relevant to clients, and that allows my attention span to be completely focused on the topic or subject that I'm working on. So that's just one thing that I've always found, to ditch the laptop for certain tasks and use the laptop for certain tasks. But going old school and using notepads really helped me in terms of like my attention and my focus, because you see a notification from an email or a WhatsApp or wherever it might be, naturally just click, oh, let me just see what that's about. And then your focus is taken away. You're thinking about something else. You're reading something else. And then you'll be like, oh, what was I working on again? It kind of counterproductive at times.
I think that's totally right. There's a bit in the book that I'm thinking about trying to write around distraction, and whether actually there's a query about whether social media obviously is inbuilt to distract, but there's a slightly wider point around my part of my thesis or whatever it is actually because of the ubiquity of all of this information that's available for people to be able to use to their advantage. Mm. Sometimes you've got to see social as the positive, so long as it can be almost captured in the right way. So, you know, if you want to know more about the music industry, read three pieces of content, or, effectively find three pieces of content that might be enjoyable for you to read or listen to or engage with on a particular day. But what you've got to be very careful about is then, if you're being doing on your phone, to have that distraction away from the thing that you actually need to do. And the query being whether it's actually social media that is the most current manifestation of distraction, because it's the easy thing to do. But actually, distraction is something slightly different. And when I was reading this particular thing, distraction is the opposite of traction, which is staying on the path and doing the thing that you want to do. And I'd never in my brain sort of quite worked out that traction and distraction are sort of opposites to a degree. So that in a way, social and your phone is just, again, the latest iteration of distraction, but actually it's more to do with your own personality traits. The idea of needing distraction for whatever trigger, emotional trigger or otherwise, is the cause of you having to reach for your phone, to be distracted, to do the thing. So as long as you have that under control, which granted a lot of people might not have, myself included at the best of times, then you can use tech to your advantage. But again, it needs to be managed in quite a stringent way.
Yeah, I think it's that element of, I think what you've just said hits the nail on the head, because so many people will start doing something, get distracted, move to something, not finish off that article that they're reading or whatever. And I think a few years ago when first started the business and stuff, I used to read a lot around articles to do with other businesses or the industry or industry trends, learning consumer trends, X, Y, and Z. And I used to use this app called Pocket App. I would save the links in there. And then when I knew that, okay, this is time I'm going to set aside to read this, all the articles were lined up. So I'm not in the space of Twitter. I'm in the space of just complete articles. Bear in mind, I've stopped doing that now because I've stopped reading articles so much, because I think they confuse or distract me more from my own vision than they do kind of help me now. But back then, when you want to learn so much around the industry and consumers and other intricacies of the work that you're doing, that was always quite helpful.
Yeah, no, I think so. That's one thing I'm trying to explore a little bit more, which is quite a cool place. If I just turn just briefly, at least also just a couple of last points. So one of the points, I don't like using the F word, which is failure, because I don't think failures are actually quite apt in the same way that everyone says they're passionate about stuff. But after reading particular things on passion, I'm not sometimes sure passion is the right word for wanting to get into a particular area. I sort of, the more I'm reading, the more I'm thinking actually people are curious about things rather than passionate about things. Mm. You're curious about wanting to learn more about it. Simply because when I was reading about passion, I was reading the Angela Duckworth book, Grit, and she was talking about passion being the Latin structure for passion is to suffer, which I found quite interesting. Granted, we may suffer sometimes for the work that we do because it is quite tricky sometimes and difficult, and you need to invest in the long term and all that type of stuff. And that's why I don't think sometimes see failure as the ultimate be all and end all and the F word, etc. But I think it's more to do with, you know, when there are bumps in the road and things don't go to plan, and when things become difficult and tricky and you have to try and handle things in different ways, how you manage to stay resilient, how you manage to gain traction, how you manage to stay on the path in face of things that crop up. Have you got any either experiences or insights as to how you go about doing that for either the business, for people in your team, for stuff in life generally?
Yeah, I think we have to accept everyone makes mistakes. Mistakes lead to situations which aren't planned for, right? So you can't ever run a business or manage a team without knowing people will make mistakes. But I think the key things for me is always the accountability of that mistake, in terms of, unless you take accountability for it, you won't learn from it. There's a fine balance between making a mistake, being like, yeah, I made a mistake, I'm moving on from it, or making a mistake, understanding where that mistake came from or how it came about, and learning from it to make sure that it never happens again. So for me, you can't learn or grow unless you make mistakes, but you have to take that accountability for it to understand where the mistake comes from, to then be able to know, okay, next time this will not happen because this is where it's wrong and this is where I will do it differently. But it's that fine mentality to be able to do that. And I think you have to be so resilient in knowing that you've made a mistake, because some mistakes can be extremely small, some can be extremely big. I made a huge mistake pre-COVID, which was the expansion of the business was done in a way which maybe me reflecting back on it was naive, in the sense that you weren't accounting for different situations that can come around which are out of your control. People always say to me, oh, but you could never have seen it coming. But that's not the point. The point is that this could have been something else, which may not have been a global pandemic. It may have been something else. Recessions, we had one in 2008. It's not too far since we had one. So you should, as a business owner, always be mindful that there will be different external factors that will hamper you. But that unless I took accountability for it, unless I understood where I went wrong, and unless I actioned something about it, you're just going to be completely naive to what's gone on, and you'll make that same mistake again and again and again, and at some point it's really going to hurt you. So for me, it's always about the accountability and always about the learning from that mistake, because they're inevitable. No human's perfect.
And I think one thing I learned from the great book, again, that features quite heavily in almost a lot of my thinking, is called Mindset by a lady called Dr. Carol Dweck. And she talks about the difference between a growth mindset and a fixed mindset. And the growth mindset effectively being, yes, I'm accountable to my mistakes, but I'm not owned by my mistakes, or the equivalent of it, which is I'm not defined by them. And so long as someone believes that their abilities are not fixed, that they can effectively grow their own brain, that they can get better, that things can be learned, and you can excel over even a short or medium to long term, that contrasts with a fixed mindset, which is I'm only as good as my last piece of work, and I'm completely defined by it, which means if my work is failing, then I am a failure and there's nothing much I can do about it. And whereas on one side, it's like, accountability for your own mistakes is almost like, yes, these are the things that I can do better and I can improve on as a result, rather than, no, it's someone else's fault and it's things that are out of my control, which were the result of things that can happen. And usually, from reading lots of things, it is that growth mindset person, which is I can get better, and also the things that I can get better with, I can control more of, or feel that I can be in control more of, that is likely to lead to a more positive outcome as a result.
Yeah, no, it's exactly that. That's the part behind all of this, which is unless you learn from it,
yeah,
it's a pointless task to be doing something that you're not going to learn from or grow from, because it's like you mentioned, that fixed mindset, in terms of you set a ceiling to yourself and you're probably not going to go beyond that ceiling. Whereas if you take that growth mindset and that accountability factor, and not everyone can do that. I've come across people within our team, people that I've worked with externally, that something goes wrong, oh, that wasn't my fault. Okay, but it was. But if you just took accountability for it, the situation would be far easier to deal with than you just saying that wasn't my fault, because there is a generational problem within certain generations, which is that it's someone else's responsibility. It's outside of my kind of day to day. So that's nothing to do with me. But yeah, I think that's just a mindset thing again.
No, exactly. And a few people have talked to me about, people that have had impacts on their careers or otherwise. I know we've talked a bit about mentorship or people giving advice to you over the years or otherwise. Has any of that featured prominently in sort of your progression to date, or has it almost been a conscious decision to do things in a slightly different way?
For me, it's always been to live and breathe my own mistakes. So my point has always been to myself that if you make a mistake yourself, you're more likely to learn from it and not do it again than listen to someone else's mistake, because it's not relatable to you. And for me, it was all about, if I'm going to do this, I want to do it in a way which I can never have any regrets. So for me, it was all about having, choosing not to have a mentor, or choosing not to have someone that's done it in the past, or someone that's been successful in something else, because they've been successful off of their own opportunities, off of their own gut feeling, their own instincts. And I think when you can ask as many questions to make your decision, but what I would never do is put myself in a situation where I say to someone, can you make a decision for me? I know that's not what mentors meant to do, but I do feel that mentors or people that, especially when it comes to running a business, they don't live and breathe your business. They don't live and breathe the everyday challenges between personnel, between functionality, between processes, between clients, between a vision. Ultimately, only you as the business owner or the people that run the business can do that. So for me, it was all about, okay, I will read, I will listen, I'll adapt information back towards what we are doing, like as myself or as the business, but most importantly, always learn from my own mistakes rather than someone else's mistakes, because maybe we're not in that position to make that same mistake. And you can become a bit too focused on not making a mistake than doing something good. It's ultimately, like, if you bring it back to football, you might not want to play a forward pass because you don't want to make the mistake that someone else has made mistake in the past by consistently giving a possession away. So what you do is you just pass it sideways and backwards. Again, you're not going anywhere with that. However, my point has always been, okay, if you want to change an industry or you want to change mentality of consumers or people within that industry, we can only do that by doing things differently to what other people have done before in the past. So rather than being too focused on other people's mistakes, I'd rather focus on what we're very good at and what we want to achieve within the industry. And if we, and when we make mistakes, not if we will make mistakes, when we make those mistakes, to learn from them. And I think in the past 4 years, there's been a complete rapid growth of being engaged as a business. And the team internally always say this, every project, we learn so much from it. Not necessarily because of mistakes, but because of new ideas, new ways of working with people, new ways of collaborating with people, new feedback, whatever it might be. Every project we grow. So the day we stop doing that is the day we as a business aren't going to be succeeding as well as we do. So for me, it's always about, yes, when people say you guys are growing fast, you're doing this, you're doing that, I take that as a compliment to the team, which is they are learning so fast every single day. They are learning something new. And for me, that part is the most rewarding out of it, rather than having a mentor tell me, oh, your team could do this, or maybe you should put that person in that place. I have had external consultants come in and kind of help us on that. But when I hear the advice, I'm like, okay, but you haven't really understood the person as a dynamic behind the professional. Mm-hmm. That this person, one, maybe their parents are ill, or there's something going on in their personal life that you've ignored all the personal factors to this, because you've just come in, asked some business questions, given me a business answer, and that's the complete humane side of all of this. So for me, I'd rather know the people, push them into a position where they can learn as professionals. I think that for me is probably a better process than having mentors.
Yep. No, I completely understand that. I think for me, I've been lucky enough because I'm in much more of a structured law firm environment, is the truth as well. With more process-driven ways as well, that you end up gravitating towards people and trying to take bits and pieces away from people who are more senior than you, that are in quite a hierarchical structure as well, that sort of resonate in lots of different ways. But I could completely see that is definitely more difficult in the creative sector, and especially in sort of the business that you've been running, which, although it's grown rapidly, is not in the same way as me, like the 700 or 800 lawyer, European law firm, which probably in the past would have been a bit different. So, you know, completely see that. Last question for you. And thanks again for your time, which is, so you've got this massive billboard that you could say anything to inspire others with. You're allowed to have a couple of sayings if you want to. What would they say?
Then the first one we always say in the office, bring solutions, not problems. If you're going to highlight an issue, be prepared to bring a solution with that issue, which is productive. If you're just bringing a problem and not maybe highlighting some sort of analysis around it, it's pretty much you're moaning about something, which is completely counterproductive, because you can influence someone else's opinion of someone, something, or whatever it might be, in a negative way, and that's just got a spiral decline with it. And I think the second one would be listen more than you talk. I think there's not necessarily a lot of people do this, but I think when you listen, you're capturing information. You can then capture that information and relay it in the way that you need to. I think we've both spoken about a book in the past, actually. I think you may have given it to me, How to Make Friends and Influence People. And that book kind of epitomizes that philosophy, which is actually the more you listen, the more you can take in information, analyze it, understand that person and their way of thinking or their philosophy or whatever it might be. And you can adapt what you need to talk about to them and make them interested in you, because I have it so often where someone will just talk at me and it will just be a case of them just talking about themselves or their service or whatever it might be. And I'm just completely switched off because they haven't asked me a question to relate it back to me. And although I run a business, I hate selling to people. I will only talk, or I'll get to the point with what I'm trying to do. And the only way I can do that is by listening to that person, understanding or asking the right questions to get the information that I need. That people lose that element of actually listening more than you talk is probably one of the most valuable things that you can do as a professional.
I totally agree. I'm realizing that the for all marketing and business development and relationship building, the less I talk, the better. And then it becomes a question of recalling the important information at a later time for you to use to benefit the other person, which will also hopefully benefit yourself as well.
Yeah, exactly. Again, you're bringing a solution to someone rather than might not be a problem, rather than just talking at them in a sales pitch.
Correct. Because I think otherwise you end up selling what you want to sell them rather than what they need. And that's quite a big difference a lot of the time. Yeah. No, it's brilliant. Essen, thanks very much for your time on that. Lots of interesting stuff to contemplate. And appreciate your time as always.
No worries. Thanks as always.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Build the Invisible with me, Daniel G. We hope you've enjoyed today's conversation and took away some valuable insights and lessons. If you'd like to learn more about the strategies and mindset discussed on the show, be sure to check out the book, my book, Build the Invisible, and the accompanying BTI journal, both available at www.buildtheinvisible.com. We also encourage you to leave us a review and subscribe to keep up to date on future episodes. Thanks for listening.